U.S. Government, of Maduro himself. Could you talk about the ability of this administration to survive?
Well, I think that the key thing is that, again, most U.S. policymakers continue to look at Venezuela as Maduro teetering because, again, their main informants are Guaido and the opposition. Rather than open up space, rather than engage in conversation, in negotiations, Maduro actually still has military support. We saw that once again on Sunday when the so-called invasion happened.
We have 5 seconds, Miguel.
So I think it's fundamental to understand Venezuela needs negotiations and conversation, not invasions.
Miguel Tinker-Salas is a professor at Pomona College in Claremont, California, author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio.
And good morning, everybody. This is your host, Paul Rowland, with Wednesday Talk Radio. I plumb forgot about theme music. As regular listeners know, I try to get a song every week that has something to do with the theme of the show. Of course, things are kind of off kilter these days with this COVID-19 beast that has beset us. And so I'm not at the studio as all our talk show hosts used to be, and still kind of getting used to the format. But here we are, and I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be with you. I'm going to have my guest Karen Hickson on with me in just a minute. Before we start the program, I just want to thank everybody. As you know, we did cancel our regular spring membership drive, and we've been sort of gently reminding you at every opportunity to nevertheless either send in your support by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. That's KBOO Community Radio. Or go online, kboo.fm, and click on the donate button. We really do appreciate everybody who has supported us thus far. And if you aren't currently a supporter, please consider doing so. We are listener-sponsored, and you are a listener. So if you are not struggling economically right now, to the extent that you're not able to give us some of your hard-earned money, please consider sending some of it our way, because we are a vital community resource and needed now more than ever. So with that, this is our first Wednesday program. It's the first Wednesday in May, in which I generally focus on issues of mental and emotional health and liberation from oppressive structures and attitudes towards people in crisis. I'm going to be basically continuing the conversation I had last month with Bob Nickel, dealing with the emotional and mental toll of this pandemic. And so I'm going to be talking, as I said, with Karen Hickson, who has been a mental health counselor in Portland since 2002 with a focus on social justice and anti-oppression-based perspectives. She has also been organizing with her local mental health comrades in the group Empathy Riot since the 2016 election. And we're going to be talking about the subject, our collective mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
I'm so glad, and I did neglect to mention that the among other reasons. The reason specific reason you're on is because you're also be giving a talk that's going to be live streamed as part of the regular monthly event series that Rethinking Psychiatry has every month, the first Wednesday of the month, and that will be starting at 7, and there's a link. Well, you can just go to rethinkingpsychiatry.org, be the most direct way, or on my program page, KBO.FM, you can also visit it that way, and it tells you all about how to sign up to get this live stream. And let's just dive right into it. I just read an article that you might have probably come across as well on the Washington Post. The coronavirus pandemic is pushing America into a mental health crisis, in which they said that one poll has nearly half of people in the United States reporting that the coronavirus crisis is harming their mental health. Another factoid, a federal emergency hotline for people in emotional distress registered a more than 1,000% increase in April compared with the same time last year. This is maybe stuff that people aren't hearing as much about as the direct physical health effects of this terrible bug that has hit the planet. So have you yourself, in your practice, been dealing with this? I assume you have.
Yeah, absolutely. And for everyone, Paul, it ranges, you know, what the virus is bringing up for them emotionally. Of course, there's the obvious impacts of isolation and social physical distancing, as well as health anxiety and fear. Our clients who already have anxiety disorders or OCD kind of tendencies, and I say those diagnostic words respectfully, who are feeling even more anxious about things like contamination and fear around the virus. And then, of course, there's the complexity of how the larger macro level impact of the virus is harming people and communities, not equitably, but inequitably, regarding the economic impacts and the larger political impacts. So I'm definitely seeing that in my practice. People are definitely struggling. Of course, we're creative when we need to be, figuring out how to take care of ourselves and each other, but it is definitely a rough time for many, and mental health is already, as you know, and your advocacy that talking about this topic is awesome. It's hard to talk about mental health for some people. It's hard to bring that out into the open. And luckily, you know, there's a lot of resources on social media, and like you said, the media is bringing the mental health concerns to the forefront at times, but it's often a forgotten part of something like this, like a national, international crisis.
You know what, I was in that article, which I really recommend people go, I linked to it on my program page, and there's been a number of other articles similar, but that this is nothing new with pandemics in the past. They've always been accompanied by what the article referred to as a shadow pandemic, mm-hmm. which hits maybe weeks or months or even later after the physical pandemic hits.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're going to be seeing those impacts for a long time because of the way that this pandemic has been handled specifically in our country, which has caused a lot of confusion. And I think, Paul, increased uncertainty when, of course, there's already uncertainty in something like a global pandemic, but people are feeling, you know, it's hesitant about the future. They're not certain what their jobs are going to be like. They're not certain if they're going to get ill, if loved family members are going to get ill and die. They're not certain if their community is going to look the same when we come out of this. There's so many layers, and of course the social conditions that we're all living in are part of our mental health. And, you know, that's why we talk about it in the ways that we do when we support groups like Rethinking Psychiatry, because they're trying to offer, you know, more complex, a more nuanced understanding of why mental health is important and why mental health is challenging for many people.
Yeah, you know, as I talked about with Bob Nickel last month, he was talking a lot about grassroots approaches, which I know is something that's very close mm-hmm. to your own approach and what you're directly involved in. He mentioned, obviously, groups like Icarus and the Portland mm-hmm. Hearing Voices. These are one, groups that I'm sure you'd talk about as well. But you yourself, along with other mental health professionals, organized a group. This sounds really interesting. I looked at your website and heard a little bit about it. But talk a little bit about Empathy Riot and how that started.
Yeah, absolutely. My activism was around before I became a professional mental health counselor, so it was always my hope that I would, you know, bring politics into mental health and not just see mental health care as a sort of individualized approach. And so alongside
you want to talk a little bit about that first, you know, just, you know, your sort of your political persona.
I'm sort of focused on social justice, anti-oppressive practices, and for me that work began and evolved through going to college and finding more support and education for issues that became close to my heart, whether those are women's rights or animal rights or you know, other issues that came up at that time many years ago. And then that evolved for me over the course of time into being deeply concerned about issues of capitalism, deeply concerned about oppression, racism, et cetera, and always wanting to bring those issues into my own mental health practice and not just professionalize them, Paul, but to be part of the community that works on issues of improving the lives of our community by recognizing the social conditions we're living under and how that's making everything much harder for us. So that's sort of a basic context, but Empathy Riot came out of, you know, that coming up to the election in 2016 and all the, like, you know, stress and frustration surrounding Trump being elected, and, you know, the day after the election was a particularly hard day for many people and mental health counselors to sort of go to work and say, oh gosh, here we are. So I organized a meeting with a couple of my colleagues in December of 2016 to just get a group of mental health professionals and peers together to talk about what is likely going to be the impact psychologically, the Trump as president, on people and their mental health, and how are we going to organize together to ensure that there are some grassroots efforts to support people's mental health. So Empathy Riot started in that meeting of like 50 or 60 professionals and turned into like a core group of organizers. And we've done various things, and we focused a lot of our energy those first 2 years on street protests and being present in the streets for various things that occurred post-Trump, whether that was the increase in hate crimes or the mass stabbing that occurred here in Portland. But we would show up on the streets, and, you know, we did that for a couple of reasons. One, to let people know that mental health professionals do care about what's going on in the world and that we're there for people in that way. And two, we also provided emotional support, de-escalation, resource and referrals at protests too, because, you know, as you may know, protests can be kind of traumatizing, and people usually have some trauma from being involved in street action, so they're out there tentatively uncertain of how it's going to go, if the police are going to activate things like flashbangs or tear gas, or if things are going to get violent. So we've done a lot of other things that we can talk about, but that's sort of where we started. Was, you know, things were really active in the years leading up to Trump, when you consider things like the Black Lives Matter movement and all of the police shootings and all the other actions that occurred in Portland. So, yeah, that's where we started, and we've evolved, and we've done various different projects. One of the mm-hmm. most important things we've probably done is provide a provider support group, because, of course, mental health practitioners also need support, as you can imagine. So being able to provide a place for people to discuss the impact of this political time on their own work and on their clients and on the systems that they work in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be, I certainly don't want to sound flippant, but, and I've been in therapy some myself, and I seriously wonder about, you know, going to see somebody and telling them really some pretty heavy duty things about myself, and then like thinking, oh, they're going to see somebody else in an hour or whatever. Like, where? Mm-hmm. How do they deal with all this stuff? It's so mm-hmm. maybe that's something that maybe people don't think about much.
Yeah, I feel like I have a lot of great, caring clients who do think about me, but I don't think it's great for them to think about me too much because they need to focus on themselves, right? So a lot of that responsibility for our care, you know, is our personal responsibility, and we create our own little communities of care to help us sustain the work and to help us stay resilient and hopeful in these very difficult times. I mean, I was a counselor during the Bush era, during 9/11, and I thought at that time, oh, this is hopefully going to be the hardest time that I'm a counselor. And, you know, I had no idea, couldn't have imagined we would be dealing with both Trump and a global pandemic later. So I thought that would be the hardest time, and now it's turning out that this is a very difficult time to provide support to people. And our self-care, which is, you know, typically left up to us, is very, very important, and we need to create communities of care. And that's one of the reasons why I created Empathy Riot with a couple of my comrades, is to provide more of that care. So it's not just the individual counselor's responsibility to just, quote unquote, take care of themselves, and we can take care of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, support groups seem to be more and more needed. And I know that again, referring to that Washington Post article, was talking about some real fears that mental people in the field of mental health are looking at in terms of, you know, we already know that mental and emotional distress are heightened by unemployment and other economic struggles. So, you know, you've got the multiple effects of this pandemic and people facing multiple levels of struggle and distress. And it, you know, we know that economic struggles already lead to greater suicide, substance uh-huh. abuse, and that sort of thing. So this is, you know, it behooves us to form our community responses now, you know, because it's uh-huh. it's there's a chance that this is gonna, you know, this is gonna continue.
Absolutely. And so having that support come from multiple directions, obviously you and I've talked about, like, the mutual aid groups that have been popping up, which provide awesome non-hierarchical material relief to people. And lots of people are doing, you know, different support groups online. And in some ways, you know, the online platforms offer more opportunities for there to be group support. Typically, as a counselor, you know, I really want to evolve my work eventually into more group work, because obviously my clients are, they're all talking about similar things, right? And so why be isolated and talk about that? So the opportunity to do support groups or just webinars on Zoom has, like, you know, it's blown up, you know, sort of webinars or the new street protest in the time of COVID. And that's amazing. And I think we need to think about ensuring that there are all kinds of levels of support for people with regards to mental health. Like you said, the crisis lines are experiencing a huge uptick in calls. People are deeply distressed in various layers, like you said. And then there's, you know, support groups and things like Icarus, things like, you know, Portland Hearing Voices, things like NAMI, things like, there's lots of different options in the world. And then there's obviously professional services, which, you know, can be challenging to secure for people. There's a lot of institutional barriers to securing professional mental health care, which I'm sure you and I could talk about for hours, but that's its own beast to figure out. How do I get a counselor with the insurance that I have is a very interesting question. I just put together a guide for service industry workers regarding mental health, and I wrote out all of the steps it might take, you know, to secure a professional mental health counselor with your insurance, and it can be quite challenging.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a call-in show. It's Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Roland, calling in from my home and speaking with Karen Hickson, who's a mental health counselor in Portland, has been since 2002, and along with her professional work and her personal activist work, also got together with other mental health comrades to form Empathy Riot about after the around the 2016 election. This is also a call-in show.
We have Sean on the line.
We can offer direct guidance or support, maybe, but if you have your own experiences or your own ideas, thoughts, questions, 503-231-8187 is the number. It sounds like we might have someone already.
Yeah, we have Sean.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. You know, anybody that's taken even like a freshman level political science course has heard of the pendulum theory. This whole idea that American politics over the centuries, you know, goes back and forth. One of the things that's got me super anxious, and I'll just say it, frightened and even panicky, is the fact that it seems like this neo-feudal movement, this neo-royalist movement, believes that they don't need the pendulum to swing back in favor of the people anymore. It's as if they're so confident that they've created a kind of lumpen proletariat, scissor bill, broken population, that they're just going to let this economic inequality just completely get even more out of control. That just fills me with like terrible fear that they are so confident. And it seems like therapy, rather than like liberation psychology, something that could inform and help the people push back against this, we have a very accommodationist version of theory that preaches things like radical acceptance, where you just conform yourself, you become well-adjusted to the injustice. So all of this has just got me very upset and very worried, and I was wondering if your guest could comment on any of that. Thank you.
Tell me your name again.
Sean.
That's his name, Paul. Sean.
Sean. Yeah, go ahead. I guess he's off. He's off now.
Oops. Are we back?
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah, I love that question. I didn't totally understand every single concept that the caller was speaking about, but I think that is why I talk of radical mental health in the terms that your caller was referring to, is that if we do not consider the political context and like the caller was speaking of, the out of control economic impacts of capitalism and greed, then we are supporting our clients and just adjusting to the conditions. And that is why I brought politics to mental health when I started. And I think it is absolutely terrifying to think about the out of control economic impacts. And when I saw yesterday that Trump was, you know, starting to disband the coronavirus task force, it made me just as dread, full of dread as the caller regarding, like, they're just going to kind of let us sort of fall apart out here, you know, the 99% of us. And so psychological tools and interventions, Paul, you and I were talking about interventions yesterday, they can be used in one of two ways, right? To help the individual adapt to oppressive conditions, or to help an individual liberate themselves and push back against the social conditions and the context upon which they find themselves. And that is why I think having a political perspective in counseling and psychotherapy is extremely important, because I don't want to use radical acceptance to get someone to just accept the conditions of their life. I only want to use a tool like that, or mindfulness for that matter, to help someone calm their internal system so that they can be more effective in fighting the social conditions that are harming and oppressing them. So for me, that's an intentional way that I practice, and I really appreciate the caller's question and comment and all the complexity that the caller was holding about how much the economic conditions of the United States impact our mental health and our fear and our uncertainty about the future. So I get it. I hear them.
One thing that I want to push back on a little bit, and it's not like I even think I totally understand it in any way, but the idea that it's coming out of a place of confidence, that they're confident that they think they can maintain, I would suggest, yeah, there is a certain confidence based upon the amassed wealth and power, but that amassed wealth and power rests upon possibly some very shaky, you know, conditions. I mean, we saw how much wealth mm-hmm. was wiped out, you know, 10 years ago in the what was now we call the Great Recession, as we head into possibly an even greater depression. But it's a, you know, capitalism really is a shell game, and they have to continue gambling and continue speculating on the future, and basically basing that speculation on risks, the idea that they're going to be able to continue to win at the game, but winning is not a given. Winning is based upon, I would say, it's based upon more and more ruthless wielding of power, and that's the real danger. Is that because it is ultimately a fragile system, it does have a tendency to morph into fascism when its foundations are radically threatened, as happened, you know, in the 20s and 30s when the first wave of fascism. So yeah, I don't know. The whole idea of confidence, I think it's really important to understand, really to try to get into a sort of almost a psychological analysis of fascism, like Wilhelm Reich did. That really it's based upon kind of an emotional repression in a way. I don't know. What do you think about some of that stuff?
Yeah, and I haven't studied William Reich as much as I've wanted to. That's one of the challenges of being a practicing mental health professional, is you are hustling and working and supporting people. But yeah, the psychology of fascism is, I think, extremely important to consider. And I think I worry a lot about the mass group of folks who are minimizing concerns about fascism right now, because I think that it is extremely concerning, things that are happening not only in the U.S. but other parts of the world that are pushing us towards that fascist approach. And I think that, you know, capitalism has become internalized to people psychologically in some ways, and there's tons of misinformation out there about what has been happening in our political landscape the last decades. I mean, you know, like I told you, I grew up in southwestern Pennsylvania during the Reagan era, and so, you know, things that occurred that time and even before, leading to the roots of some of what people are struggling with right now, and some people are just not even willing to discuss politics at this point, and so many people are not active, and so you have these folks at the upper echelons of society, like the billionaires. You know, how much did Jeff Bezos' wealth increase over the last 8 weeks? And then you have the sort of activists, radicals, progressives, you know, people who are deeply concerned about things, and then you have a large group of people who are just sort of like, when can I go back to Target? You know? So I think we have to keep talking about these things, the psychology of fascism and the impact of, you know, misinformation, and you know, people are struggling to figure out where they're going to come into this issue of the divisions of this country, right? The political divisions that are occurring, and it's been a tough time to even have conversations with people about what's happening in the U.S. Because there are so many political divisions, and people are very stuck on what they think is happening and who's right and who's wrong, and it's just a lot, Paul. I mean, we could talk about this stuff for days and weeks.
It's true, and well, we should, and that's again one of the things that, you know, I think I don't know, personally, I found myself relying on the telephone somewhat more. I've sort of been somewhat self-isolating for a number of years as I sort of take care of my elderly mother here and I won't go into my personal oddities, but yeah, so I know about personal isolation to some extent. I'm not, you know, I know there's people who are having their own serious, you know, personal health issues, aging issues, like way more than me, but I can, you know, I can identify. But I kind of forgot where I was going with that. Let me just say that this is a Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Karen Hickson. We're talking about collective mental health responses in this age of this pandemic.
You have a caller.
To get together. Looks like we have another caller, so let's go to them.
Marilyn,
go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like the... Oh, rats. I've got a echo here. I'd like the Karen to talk about... about hope
and what she tells her clients about, or what they talk about, what she thinks about in terms of hope and positive thinking. Thank you.
Thanks, Marilyn.
Yeah, hope and positive thinking are very tricky for me personally, because
if we get that tone down, there we go.
Okay, great, we're back. Hope and positive thinking are very tricky for me. I've always felt a little concerned when some of those things are purveyed as the sort of answers to our suffering, when they are not considered inside the political context. So for me, hope is active. It's an active event. It's an active attitude of continuing to push forward despite our fear of the future, or despite our concerns that things won't work out. And, you know, positive thinking is such an interesting topic, and I think Reimagining Recovery has done some great talks in Portland on toxic positivity, regarding, you know, how can positivity be used to sort of anesthetize the population instead of sort of wake them up into action, into starting to look at the social conditions of their lives. So I think hope is so important. I don't know if positive thinking is super important. I think that obviously there's depression and struggle and things that keep us from feeling like we can care for ourselves or care for our communities, and it's important to address that, especially as a counselor. But I think we have to have hope, and it has to be active. And so I really just try to encourage people to, you know, think outside their own bubble and consider what they can do to care for each other, their community, and themselves, and to find resources, inspiration, philosophy, poetry, art, music, many other things that are interdisciplinary that allow them to increase hope. And I like Rebecca Solnit's book on hope, too. But I think that I struggle a little bit as a mental health counselor around, you know, paradigms that are put forth that are really just meant to quiet us. So I'm a little skeptical of certain things, but I think there's a lot of good things in many of the concepts that are used to help people that can be extracted and used in a cultural context. And not just in an individual pathologizing sort of way. And that's what I try to get away from in my work.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Bright Side, is a wonderful treatment of that whole issue. Her disgust for the sort of superficial, you know, put on a happy face, you know,
right,
good thoughts, as opposed to and not think deep thoughts. Not think deep thoughts, basically, and not think about what the real problems are and how to actually address them, but, you know, just to sort of superficially adapt yourself to this careening out of control situation we're in. But and then, you know, the idea that, you know, Norman Vincent Peale was actually sort of a mentor to Donald Trump, and he was sort of seen as sort of one of the originators. The idea of the power of positive thinking was a concept that he developed, is also something that should give us pause. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think of it as a life force, you know. We gotta stay with the, you know, the what is good is what helps us continue on to live in this world and to accumulate, you know, solidarity and life force with others against, you know, what I consider really the death force of the capitalist system. Really, I mean, I think there's, getting back to the psychology of it, I think there's, you know, much as I pretty much reject most of Freudianism, there's something in there about the, you know, the Eros versus Thanatos. But anyway, let's not get into all that. 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Karen Hicks, and we're talking about our collective mental and emotional health during the COVID-19 pandemic. Before we go to another caller, again, 503-231-8187, we're about halfway through here. Talk some more about, you know, you talked about Empathy Riot.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about some of these mutual aid groups that have sprung up that are giving direct support to people, whether it's food or medicines. You know, I don't know if people are actually able to give, you know, out of that. Obviously, they're able to give, you know, emotional support in terms of, like, interacting and talking to people. Probably, you know, people who are unable to leave their homes are really grateful to have someone. Like, I know Meals for Wheels is a really crucial thing, you know, for seniors, just having that, you know, even just having 5 or 10 minutes of human contact. You know, those of us who aren't in that situation can't even imagine how much that might mean. So talk more about, you know, we mentioned Icarus, we mentioned Portland Hearing Voices, maybe mention some other moments of mutual aid that you've seen developing in this time.
I mean, one of the things that's been fun for me is to hear mutual aid be discussed in the, like, mainstream. That was really neat to see that, because it's typically, like, a more marginalized concept in maybe more politically radical anarchist circles, if you will. And it's been really great to see that there's mutual aid groups popping up all over the country in communities, and people are just asking for what they need, and that is being provided with the people and by the people. And I think that's incredibly important right now, because you probably have heard, Paul, and your callers have, about the huge bureaucratic systemic failures of how our government has tried to provide aid right now to small businesses or through the stimulus check. And I think one of the most important things about mutual aid is it provides that alternative to getting your needs met through the system, and the alternative is getting our needs met through each other. So, I mean, there's guides of mutual aid projects, you know, popping up all over the country, and things like providing people direct money to pay their rent, or, you know, direct cash to buy groceries, or going to get the groceries, or getting medication. And I think mental health-wise, you know, a lot of mutual aid efforts right now are sharing resources, sharing information, sharing, you know, there's many different, like, COVID mental health guides that have popped up, or dealing with stress. And so a lot of the mental health support has been through the sharing of resources and knowledge and practices and things that we might use inside a professional therapeutic relationship, and trying to put those in the hands of the people, right? Because we're not the arbiter of those tools. You know, we can disseminate those tools as professionals. We've gone to school to study these things specifically, but a lot of mental health mutual aid has come through just, you know, sharing information and resources, and also just spontaneous, you know, groups having support sessions on Zoom. And there's still a lot of things happening via Zoom, like 12-step programs, which are a huge important thing for some people. And a lot of the webinars that have popped up are really acknowledging the complexities of the mental health situation and how this is impacting us. So there's a lot of different ways that mutual aid is, I think, helping right now, and I think we need more and more of it. And I think it's very important to just get resources and money into the hands of people that need it right now. And our system of capitalism typically uses the meritocracy or bureaucracy to distribute resources. You know, who deserves resources and who can jump through the hoops to get them? And that is, you know, a huge barrier for so many people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what popped in my mind is that it's given a whole new meaning to the idea of a sewing circle. You know, there's been this debate for years, a good debate, an important debate, where people, like, you know, say, you know, why should the whole idea of volunteerism, you know, like, why should people have to volunteer? Looks like we've got another call. We'll get in a second here. Why should we have to volunteer to make masks when at the touch of a button, or, you know, at a word, Trump could have activated. Now he's going to, you know, finally going to Arizona to trumpet his having gotten this a aerospace plant to make masks, but, you know, should have been done 3 months ago anyway. But when the state absolutely fails to do it, we really have no other recourse, And the other aspect of it is, you know, on the mental health, emotional health side is, you know, there's no antidote to despair like action. And so even if you're not able to, like, sit in a room and sew together, if
right.
you're able to do it as a you know, online collective and pool your efforts together and together make, you know, 10,000 masks in a week and, you know that you're actually helping people who
Absolutely.
Are on the medical front lines, that's really, really major. Let's go to
yeah,
our next caller.
Okay.
I don't have a caller here.
Oh, you don't have a caller.
No.
Sorry, I thought I heard you jump in.
No.
503-231-8187. We only have about 20 minutes left, so don't wait till the last 5 minutes that you're calling
well,
out. You want to respond to what I just said, Karen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is something I'm seeing being so supportive for people's mental health, is to contribute in whatever way they can. Tons of people report feeling more connection, more empathy, more like psychological ease by contributing, by volunteering to make masks, by cooking food for their community. I've seen so many people do porch drop-offs, Paul, just leaving little treats and food and reminders for people. And I think those things are extremely important. And yes, of course, the state should have responded more effectively to this crisis from the beginning. We're seeing more and more evidence that they ignored this, and you know, and the death numbers and the impacts are so huge. And you know, when you start to think about things like meat processing plants, incarceration, it's the impacts are just huge, and how those folks are being very marginalized in this. But back to, I think things like generosity and giving and contributing and being active are extremely important for our mental health. And of course, getting beyond just philanthropy, right, and getting beyond things like, you know, just fundraising and moving towards, you know, direct mutual aid or direct support of people. So I've seen a lot of benefit from people caring for each other and that helping their mental health a ton.
We have Sean online.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to get back on the line really quick and say thank you, Paul, for bringing up Bright Sided by Barbara Ehrenreich. And Karen, thanks for coming on the show. And just to embellish a little more what I was talking about, like, what gets me is I don't understand the end game. Like, what is the ruling class, what does the 1% have in store for the 99%? Is it going to be like a caste system, like India or, you know, like Brazil or something like that? Or is it going to be more chaotic? Are we going to look at like a Hotel Rwanda situation or like Mad Max? Or, you know, the imagination just boggles, you know? I mean, it just seems like this level of economic inequality is social dynamite. And it seems like it's being intentionally, it's by design. They're moving us systematically in a direction towards social and basically collapse of civilization. So,
yeah.
And McMindfulness by Ronald Purser is another great book, by the way. Just so I throw that in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, I mean, I pay attention to people in my Facebook feed who are thinking about some of the things the caller just mentioned. You know, I'm not a political science expert myself, and I haven't studied the history of all of this stuff as much as the next person. You know, I'm in my little psychology, mental health, social justice bubble in that way, but a lot of smart people in my feed are deeply concerned about social unrest coming out of this, things like the next civil war, or, you know, how we are going to end up in a very, you know, serious social unrest situation, and it's hard to know what that will look like, but it feels it feels extremely terrifying to think about. And it feels like when, you know, when a bunch of white folks who go to these state capitals to protest with, you know, with weapons, and they want the state to reopen, you know, this is a very interesting precursor of what could come. And by no means am I an expert on all of this, but it's definitely terrifying for sure.
Well, I wanted to kind of continue that discussion, sort of thought of the, I don't know, that mentioning the idea of these liberate groups, you know, brings to mind the the Patriot Prayer events that happened in Portland over the last few years that I I went to the first, I don't know, half a dozen of them, and then for my personally, I just saw sort of a point of diminishing returns for myself personally. I mean, I respect whoever went out there, you know, to combat the people, but I saw those, you know, the idea of this whole idea of snowflakes, you know, that is like this term of derision coming out of that sort of milieu, the culture wars milieu. Anyway, that getting back to the psychology of fascism or psychology of whatever that mentality, the idea of, again, Wilhelm Reich talks about the armored personality. I don't know, I think of a term of reaction formation. I'm not sure if that really applies, but you know, I consider myself a sensitive person, and I consider that to have something to do with the fact that, you know, I had a manic episode 10 years ago, you know. And I think, you know, I would guess that probably a lot of people who listen to KBOO, and I don't know if to make a generalization, people quote on the left, I don't know, that may be a bit wide, casting the net a little wide, but I think, you know, there's a certain, you know, I don't know, emotional, mental sensitivity, and then there's the sensitivity of people who are just sensitive because they're marginalized, and they are sensitized because they feel it every day, you know, they feel it on themselves, and so that just enforces a kind of sensitivity to things, whereas, you know, these people who, you know, I guess the sort of the extreme is the, you know, the people, the survivalists building their safe room and, you know, surrounding themselves with dozens of automatic weapons. That's kind of an extreme, but we see those people at some of these rallies with their automatic weapons. And I really do think, you know, the idea of them, you know, sort of, I don't know, is sort of like denying their own sensitivity. I think there's really something to that, whether that really helps us any, because ultimately, you know, if it comes down to a power struggle, you know, we have to, unfortunately, we have to kind of armor ourselves as well, you know, remain sensitive inside, but armor ourselves the best we can to survive and maintain. I don't know. That's a lot of thought.
We have a caller.
You want to respond to that quick, and then we'll bring in our caller?
Oh my gosh, there's so much in what you said, Paul, but I think, you know, sensitivity is an interesting topic in and of itself, because obviously some of our sensitivities or armor is caused by trauma, right? Whether that be personal trauma we experienced as children or, you know, trauma later in our lives. So I think trauma is just like a huge issue, and obviously for me it's obvious that it's one of the largest causes of mental health distress and people shutting down or people not feeling like they can, you know, open up to the world and other people. And I mean, there's so much to say about everything you said. I'd love to hear the next caller.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you. Getting back to hope, we create our own reality, and I grew up with one of my parents mentally ill. People don't understand that condition. Yes, of course, we're social creatures, but we can't fix this world. Byron Katie said there's three businesses, your business, my business, and God's. This world is not what we can fix. However, we still can reach out, be that compassionate person, and take small doses of mass media news. It's so skewed to support patriarchy. That's why I support KBOO. Anyway, David Ott said, hope is love with its sleeves rolled up. I love it that you said it's action. Even a small action of calling a friend, saying, hey, hang in there. Or, you know, whatever. Thank you for the work you do, all of you. And
appreciate that.
Yeah, well, and like whatever little way, support, even if you can't give a few dollars. I mean, this is not a pitch, but any action, I guess, my Buddhism is showing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think one of the things that the caller mentioned, I heard the word compassion, and I think that that is a concept, specifically compassion for others and compassion for self, that I think is extremely important for our collective mental health. Most of what I see in my counseling practice are humans being extremely hard on themselves, extremely self-critical, extremely just beating themselves up. And they do that for a number of reasons that are related to our social conditions and oppression and whatever their identities are. So I do think things like compassion and self-compassion, specifically the work of Kristen Neff, N-E-F-F, can be really helpful in getting us to be, you know, grounded so that we then can take that action-oriented hope that your caller is talking about. But when we are collapsed into our own, you know, selves, where we feel like we don't have anything to give or we don't have worth, like that is extremely challenging. And part of my work is designed to get people to see that a lot of that self-criticism is created by the culture that they live in and the marginalization they experience and the judgments that they experience from other people. So I rely on things like, you know, disability justice principles and things like that to get people to, and harm reduction, to get people to see that, like, you do not have to be perfect to be an effective human. You do not have to feel perfectly well to contribute.
Margaret's on the line.
Well, before we go to Margaret, let's go talk a little bit more about harm reduction. What does that mean in this context?
Yeah, I mean, I heard of harm reduction a long time ago. It's a philosophy related to, you know, it started out in being able to provide appropriate care, resources to drug users so that they were safer in their practices. But for me, harm reduction is a sort of life philosophy of meeting yourself where you're at. Our culture is obsessed with perfection. It's obsessed with regimens and plans and fixing and spiritual bypassing. And I think harm reduction can be an awesome philosophy for just, you know, every day of this pandemic has been different for people, right? So you might create a plan for today that's like, here's what I need to do for myself today, but that plan might need to change tomorrow because your conditions have changed, your inner mind states have changed. So you can't just say, I'm going to exercise every day. You can't do that. You have to meet yourself where you're at and adjust your care plans based on what your actual needs are in this moment. And I could also talk about harm reduction forever, but I think it's an excellent concept for getting away from the idea of the cure or the fix or the exact program that will help us feel better or more effective or more functional.
Mm-hmm. I guess kind of as a, maybe our previous caller said, you can't fix the world, but perhaps you can do some harm reduction. I would personally say, mm-hmm. I don't believe necessarily in fixing anything, but I do believe in engaging in struggle. And I do believe that the system is, we need to understand how it originated and how it works, but we need to confront it, and direct action is the best way. But we do have another caller on the way, on the line. I believe it's Margaret. If that's true, go ahead.
Mark.
Hi,
Mark,
Paul.
Sorry.
Thanks for a very liberating discussion, both you and Karen. I want to recommend an article that I uploaded on indiebay.org. It's a translated article titled Corona, Capitalism, and Nature, a Fatal System Error. And one of the great problems we face is that our thinking is too individualistic, and that system criticism and system analysis has been made taboo. Actually, as the writer points out, false theories have been imposed for 40 years, that regulation is a necessity. that the wealth tax is not madness, but urgently necessary, and that public investment has to be viewed as investment and not a cost. So I recommend the article. Our thinking is so twisted and so parochial. We individualize, we psychologize, and we are part of an elite democracy that just seems to carry on without the 99%. So I hope you'll check out that article. Also, a website, academia.edu, which has 23 mm-hmm. million papers. It could uh-huh. be the people's publisher. So this is very liberating.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much for that.
What's the name of the article one more time, if you're still on the line, caller?
Corona, Capitalism, and Nature.
Cool.
All right, we'll check it out. Thanks.
Very good.
I've appreciated Naomi Klein doing tons of webinars in the first few weeks of the coronavirus crisis, talking about coronavirus capitalism and how this pandemic will be used to just lift up the ruling elite and making them more money. And I think people are starting to point out that this open up the states is more about making sure that the people at the top can earn their money. So it's complicated, but I appreciate that larger analysis of what's going on, and appreciate that people are talking about it, thinking about it.
Well, we got about 5 minutes left. Let me just put out that there's one last chance here to call in. 503-231-8187. Have time for perhaps one more caller. After that, we'll have to close it off. Do we have anybody on hold?
No, it's all quiet. All quiet.
Okay. So, there's so many different directions we opened up, which generally mm-hmm. happens on this show, and it's really interesting. It really changes things not having someone to actually look in the eyes in the studio.
Yeah.
It makes a really big difference. I'm noticing it's much easier. To and I don't mean to reinforce anybody's sense of isolation, but I'm just observing that being in person. So if we can start getting in person like 6 feet apart more, that's one thing I'd like to see. I mean, why should these liberate people start to get the monopoly on activism? I know we've been having caravans. One thing I've really liked. Is the nurses and medical professionals doing their protests and being very uh-huh. observant of social distancing, and I think those have been really powerful. And I think we can do that. I think we do need to start working on finding ways, to gather in small, medium sized groups at least to and being very, very mindful about how we do it. I don't know. I just think it's really important to. That as Oregon does start to itself open back up to the extent, because we have been very observant, and I commend myself, yourself, everybody for observing. It's been really important, uh-huh. To do something that's never really been done. And I've been listening to the Italians. The Italians are all. Yeah. I lived in Italy for many years, and it's so funny hearing them. Because they're such an amazingly social and physical people, they really are, and it's interesting to hear them sort of congratulating themselves for how well they've been able to go along with these really stringent dictates. Anyway, that's something I've been thinking about. How about you? What have you been thinking about?
I mean, I think that's on my mind too, Paul. The sort of next stage, I could feel something shift last week on week 7 of the sort of stay-at-home order that, like, there's like an emerging anxiety of like, okay, so how are we going to come out of this isolation, and how are we going to engage in safe, safe gathering? And I think that there's so many opinions about what we should and shouldn't do, and it's very hard to figure out, like, okay, how do we step out of this isolation into community and connection and just meeting some of our people face-to-face. We're already very isolated in our little enclaves of sort of nuclear heteronormative families, et cetera. So a lot of people who are living alone really need to get out and see some people's eyes, you know, and have people in their presence, because we're different creatures when we're on this electronic device, right? Like, we're not co-regulating together. We're not in the same room. We're not getting that relational zest of, like, being together and feeding off of each other. And that's also made telemental health pretty challenging for most mental health providers. Some of them are loving it, but many of us feel a huge loss of being able to just be in the room with our clients. And I don't think that we will be in a room with our clients for quite a while because of the risks of being in an enclosed space. But I do see us being in parks, you know, physical distancing and wearing masks and trying to continue to take care of each other and protect each other. But I think Oregon has done a good job, you know, of social physical distancing and doing our best to care for the greater community. And I hope that we can, I think, manage the second phase of the pandemic. I think it's definitely caused a little bit of anxiety in me the last week, and anxiety in my clients about what to do and when and how, and it's just a very confusing and difficult time, and there's not sort of one source of guidance. So a lot of this is up to small communities of people to figure out how they want to, you know, what risks they want to take and how they want to gather. But I think a lot of people are needing some outdoor time too. Nature, it's a huge loss right now to not be able to be in nature and to be with other people in nature. So we're
The music is coming up, and this is, we could just, okay, as you said earlier, go on and on. This is really wonderful.
Yes.
Been talking to you, Karen
thanks
Hickson. Thank you so much for coming
on.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for
all having
me.
And you'll be live streaming tonight at 7. Go to rethinkingpsychiatry.org. We got to go. Thanks you very much.
Okay. Bye, Paul. Take care.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m. It's time for Inside Washington County.
Information on Grendel's Facebook.